So it's a great pleasure and honour to have a chance to talk to Anne Lonsdale. And when and where were you born?
I was born in Huddersfield in February 1941. I have a sense that this may have been accidental. It was wartime, and I think they were aiming for Edinburgh. But I was born in Huddersfield. Which was actually fine, because my godmother was in Huddersfield. That's why we stopped there on the journey, and as she was a doctor, I was in good hands, and so thank goodness was my mother.
Excellent. When you say it was accidental, most viewers will have started with another alternative view, but it was the place that was accidental.
It was the place that was accidental.
Right.
Otherwise intended.
Otherwise intended. Tell me something about your parentage, as far back as you like.
Mainly Celtic, predominantly Scots. I knew two grandfathers. I never knew grandmothers. Both had died before my time. And grandfathers were really particularly notable because of huge moustaches. The sort of small child's memory is of needing to have to kiss bushy moustaches. But one had blue and one had brown eyes, so one could tell them apart.
They were both Scottish, or?
No, one was Welsh and the other was Scots. Mm. But all the rest of the family was Scots. I think of myself predominantly as Scots. My Scots grandfather spoke only Gaelic till he was 12, when he finally went to the big city of Perth, which he was deeply fond of, and so he left his worldly goods to Perth. Unfortunately, by the time he sold his worldly goods, they bought a seat on the bench of Perth Harbour, on the harbour side. And he was a sort of poor man's Bernard Shaw. He was a journalist. He wrote curious works of pseudo-literature. He was very interested in strange languages. He was very interested in codes and all sorts of things.
What was his name?
Alexander Menzies, spelt Menzies, as it were. Hmm. And he took the family through very strange pastimes and employments from one place to another, and they ended up on the embankment, certainly for one night.
This wasn't on his seat?
Not on his seat. This was the embankment in London.
Oh, I see.
And down and out in London. Thank goodness my father, who was clearly very bright, was picked up from his primary school in London and sent to Christ Hospital with a scholarship, which enabled him to become a physicist. And he's a Cambridge man, he was a Christ's man. Christ is not grateful to him because he introduced his first ever research student, C.P. Snow, Christ's. He had him as an undergraduate at Leicester and passed him on to Christ. And Christ didn't, I think, look kindly on that over the years ahead. So he was a scientist. His sister, my Aunt Alice, was again a slightly curious person. She was very much given to the theatre and to music, and she was trained as a music teacher. She was a good pianist. But she was always embarking on new and extraordinary ploys that would reach all untold wealth at the end of the day, and they never did. So there was a strange new system of learning music to which I was put at one stage, which didn't work, all to do with colours. It was much, much harder to learn than just learning music. So they were a thoroughly eccentric lot. Aunt Alice was a great believer in the second sight. My mother, who was brought up in Yorkshire but of Scottish ancestry, did not believe in the second sight at all, and was a very down-to-earth and practical person. So there were always stresses and strains there, I knew from fairly early on.
Stresses and strains between?
Oh, between Aunt Alice, who was not approved of, and my father, who was a very loyal brother, feeling that he ought to be picking her up from various problems that she ran into over the years.
What sort of character was your mother? Were you close to her?
I was much closer to my father. My mother was very uncertain of life, I think, and that made her very dictatorial. She'd come from a very simple background, and she'd gone to Leeds University as an undergraduate. Her big sister went to Newnham, and I think she always felt that big sister knew everything and could do everything, and she was inadequate. And she then married her professor at Leeds, my father was teaching physics then at Leeds and then went on to found physics departments in Leicester and Southampton before the war. And I think this brought her into a social world where she felt out of her depth. And she remained out of her depth slightly all her life, and that made her over fussy and very nervous, but very sure to me that she knew how to do things and she was right, and so inevitably I was always wrong. So this was not the best of relationships.
And your father, but with your father?
With my father, of course, I didn't really know him until I was five, because it was wartime. I was born in 1941. We came down, they'd been in Southampton till the war began, and he'd then been taken back into the Air Ministry. He flew planes in the First World War. He was in the Royal Naval Air Corps at the beginning, having lied about his age, gone from school early into the Navy, and then the Navy became the beginnings of the Air Force. And he kept his interest in all of that, and was drafted in very early into the Air Force. So he was in London, pretty well living on the job, actually, and was in central London, pretty well non-stop. My mother had a sort of base in Harrow, where actually I then went on to spend my childhood. But they needed to get me out of London, and so I was parked. I mean, I was a parcel for the first 4 years, I suppose, of my life. Sometimes with her, often without, and therefore used, I think, very early on to being an observer. And to watch and see what was happening around me and try to get bearings in very different cultural settings.
Do you think this has made you a good committee person?
I think it's made me acutely aware of body language, yes, which is a very useful part of the committee. You know, to be able to pick by a quick glance around the room where the opposition is going to come from long before it speaks. But I was very lucky because my father, I think through his links still to Cambridge, of which he was very, very fond, had links with an organisation that began in Cambridge in the 30s, I think Cain was involved in Beveridge, setting up attempts to bring German academics and Austrian academics out from the moments when they lost their university jobs in the 30s onwards. And so before I was born, I know that quite a number had come through the Southampton House survey before. And those who didn't go on to America remained friends in Britain. And I certainly spent at least 1 or 2 years of my life before I was five with the Weissenberg family in Manchester, living somewhere in Didsbury, which I remember by privet hedges, which smelt horrible. The husband, Carly, and his wife, who was actually German, had got out of Austria, where he'd been as a physicist as well. And they'd managed to get their two aged aunts out, his aunts, Tarpini and Tarpina, who wore black satin dresses and white lace collars, which they changed every time they washed the dresses, which had to be unpicked and sewn on again. And they were very small and very round, and so the satin black dresses, one slipped off them sideways when everyone was on their laps. Very, very uncertain. I knew they were very loving, but actually I found it very nerve-wracking being on their laps. And some of my earliest memories certainly are from that time, because there was such a sort of strong emotional life in that setting in Manchester. I mean, the house was always full of other refugees. They'd come from the internment camps in the Isle of Man back to Manchester. That's how they'd ended up there. And I know that I was hearing talks of people who died and what was really happening in Germany and all this sort of thing. And I knew that Carly was pleased and Lena was sad that his mother had got out just in time from their flat in Vienna by jumping out of the window when the SS came around the corner. And he thought that was a blessed release, and she didn't. And you know, I can remember listening to that with the table just about this height, and I think I was probably about three. But it made me very aware from the beginning that there was absolutely nobody in control. You know, you're on your own. You better make a good job of it.
Do you think it's affected your I mean, you spent much of your life in international relations.
Yes, and, I'm sure it did.
And in Eastern Europe. And,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my father's reaction to that period was that he'd had a lot of collaborations, particularly with Karl Weissenberg, but with others in Germany, before the war. And as soon as the war was over, he set out to rebuild those links and create meetings with them and create pan-European associations. So my summer holidays were always at European conferences.
And this is what you did a lot in the 1990s, isn't it?
Well, going back to this link up again with Eastern Europe.
Mm.
Yes. Yeah. No, it was bred in me. I was lucky.
Tell me about your schools. I don't know whether your first school influenced you at all.
I'm sure my first school did, because it was a very remarkable place, really. When I think back to the people who were there, I mean, one of them became our ambassador in the UN and then in Iraq, Jeremy Greenstock. Marcus Beresford became the head of GKN. They all seem to have gone on to enormously eminent
places. What was this amazing school then?
This amazing school was known as Miss Nix. Miss Nicholson was a very prim, tough lady who preferred dealing with small boys than small girls, and there were about 10 of us maybe in a class, in three classes. We did all did everything in those classes. It was a private school.
Where was it?
In Harrow.
Yeah.
And you know, we were expected, we read a Shakespeare play every year from year one, and then went to see it, because in Harrow School they put on the plays in the Round and the Globe. So I was used to reading, you know, real things.
This is about the age of six or seven.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Gosh.
And you know, if you didn't get it all, it didn't matter, but you got something.
Mm.
And then when you saw the play, you began to get a whole lot more, and so it went on. So that we were taught French from the beginning as well, and a bit of Latin. And it was blessed education, you know, it really was wonderful. Mm. The only downside was that the maths teacher was my mother, and that didn't work at all.
Mm.
So
and that's why you went there, presumably, was it?
No. I was already there actually when she began, but I was doing
it.
By the time I did anything which looked at all like maths, it was my mother teaching, she came into it later.
Mm.
No, it was very local, it was very close to where we lived.
Mm. And then where did you go on?
And then there was a huge debate, because they thought that for the good of my education, I should go either to somewhere like Walter London Collegiate, which was not that far away, but further than they wanted to send me, and they also thought perhaps they should send me away to school because I was an only child and I therefore got a bit more company. I objected to both those things for various reasons, and so I went to a local school, which was fine, but from the time I'd done O-levels, I worked on my own really. I went there during the day. But luckily I had teachers from Harrow, and I worked with them in the evenings.
From Harrow School?
Harrow School.
Mm.
And sort of worked in parallel with people who then I went up to Oxford with later.
Well, what was the school that you were, your day school?
The day school was Heathfield, which has moved its site now, and I think it's a good school.
A private school?
GST or whatever it's called.
It was a private school?
Private school.
Yeah.
But I was there on the 11 plus.
Were there any teachers in that phase of your life who made a special impression on you? Infused you in any way?
I think, you know, I became a classicist at that stage, and I think probably the Latin teacher. Simply because it was such a pleasure to be taught by someone who knew that there was a, you know, a right answer to this, and that you could do it properly if you tried. And that you could always go further and find more. I mean, otherwise I got a bit fed up, I think, with the levels of what were expected of us.
What about extra curricular activities? I mean, were you interested in music? You just got off to a bad start with musical colours, but after that...
I got off to a bad start with music all round, really, because I really wanted to play the cello. And the cello was deemed to be too heavy. I think that I was thought of as a very delicate child. I was asthmatic and I had pneumonia and I had assorted things. And I think that they thought I probably couldn't carry a cello. So they said, well, you know, if you start with a violin, dear, then you can learn the cello. And I hated the violin, but I thought if I practiced I might learn the cello one day. But it then turned out that my mother's worst fear before I was born had been that I would play the violin because she couldn't stand the instrument. And it was not a good thing.
Mm.
But it was great to play in orchestra. And it was great to play in the back of the second violin.
And has music meant a lot to you since then, or not?
Decreasingly, I think.
Really?
Yes, mm. Because art has become far more important to me. Visual things are very, very important. And I didn't really have any sense of that then, although my father always painted, and he was a watercolourist and painted a lot, and he painted wherever we were with a sketchbook. But I can't do anything. I mean, I can't paint, I can't write, I can't, you know, I'm non-creative.
You don't paint yourself?
No.
You just like looking at it? No. Who are your favourite artists?
Whoever I've seen latest and got excited about, I suppose. My favourite in the collection in college is Maggie Hamling's Iran, Gulf Women Go to War, which I think is a superb painting and a superb subject. And certainly she's been the person I've had greatest pleasure in meeting.
Tell me something about this famous collection in your hall. Did you start that? Or?
No, I didn't. No, I inherited it. I was jolly lucky. It began, I think, partly as a response to Newhall being grey brick, and there being almost nothing on the grey brick, and grey brick in January being horrible. And so my predecessor, Valerie Pearl, and colleagues at that time went out and asked people if they would lend or possibly even give a work. And I think the inspiration behind that had been a woman called Anne Jones, who was married to a research fellow of ours, and who now is a curator at the Hayward. And she was, I think, aware already that quite a lot of women are finding it very difficult to be shown, and that quite a lot of them also made big works, and big works couldn't be hung and weren't being bought. So she created the list of people that we wrote to, and they overwhelmingly gave. I mean, some lent, but most gave. And very few said no. And it's grown from there, and it's now grown to the stage that since we have everything on the web, people actually want to be on that website. And I think my only contribution has been from as soon as possible after I arrived to make sure that we began to have a sort of quality control element. We'd accepted everything up till now, and we didn't need to bring in quality control. So we now have an external committee that decides on what we can.
It's one of the very best collections of women's paintings, isn't it?
It's the quality from the early days is still interesting. It's actually very good for the young to be brought up in such a mixed quality, because they home in on something rather cosy to begin with, and then, you know, by the end they're saying, oh, I'm bored of that. It's that one. Going for exciting things. It's very big. It's the biggest outside Washington DC. It doesn't go back much before 1954 when we started, whereas the great collection in Washington goes right back to Black Art and Museum, Gentileschi and so on.
Were there any other, I mean, were you a games player?
Yes. Being very much on my own always, I mean, I got lots of friends at school, but I haven't got brothers and sisters, no. And my parents were already, my mother was in her 40s when I was born, so there was quite a generation gap really between me and my friends and them. And so I spent quite a lot of time, I suspect, on my own, and I'm perfectly comfortable in my own company. And so one of the things I always liked was anything to do with athletics, where you really had to sort of keep practicing and working at things like sort of high jump and hurdling and that sort of thing, where there was pace but there was a skill and a making yourself do what you wanted to do, which was always exciting. So I did quite a lot of that, and I did quite a lot of hurdling. I did stuff for sort of junior county hurdling and long jump. And liked that very much and would have gone on, but my feet have got bust up in various ways.
Did you do it at university? Or?
No.
Okay, so we take you on now to university. Where did you apply?
Oxford.
Just Oxford?
Just Oxford. Because I'd been meant to apply, I was in my lower sixth year and I was bored. And I said, I really want to have a try at Oxford. People didn't usually do it in the pre, you know, they usually completed the A-level at that stage and then applied, but I wanted to get on with life and I wanted to do something more demanding. And so asked if I could apply a year early and just try it for fun. And applied, but I didn't apply just to Oxford, I'd forgotten, I applied to Royal Holloway as well. I got a scholarship, so I went.
To which?
To St. Anne's, Oxford.
St. Anne's?
Yes.
Probably about a year before I did. 1940, was it? 1958. 58, 2 years before me, yes. That was, so you got in before your A-levels?
Yes, I went a year earlier, I was 17, I think. But it was great.
Tell me about Oxford. I mean, bring back happy memories, I'm sure.
Well, it was just so nice to be amongst people who liked the sort of things I did. I mean, the school I was at was a school of super people, but most of them stopped at A-level and hoped to be hairdressers, and they didn't really see what I was interested in. And so it was great to be surrounded by very bright people. And I was passionate about classics and did mods and grades, which was a wonderful course then. And so was just caught up in ideas and in, not in proper Oxford philosophy, which was never my thing at all, but you know, is a strawberry a red round whatever object, but in the history of ideas, I suppose, as they would have called it then, in philosophers of the past, in political philosophy.
Mods and Greats in classics? Or
Mods and Greats was in classics, but that opens out into all sorts of things.
So you went to Isaiah Berlin and...
Oh, yeah. Yes, and there were people all around you to go and listen to every night, things to get involved in that.
Were there any teachers in those years who...
Oh, lots.
Particularly.
Iris Murdoch was my moral philosophy tutor.
Was she? Gosh, what was she like? And,
she was an extraordinarily realistic and kind person. She was outstanding. And very funny. And... very, very quick and a marvellous tutor. I mean, in Oxford in those days, you read your essay aloud, which was terrific because you could then hear the stupid things you could say, and you could hear the non sequitur, you know, all of those things were clear at once. And I think it's a wonderful way of learning. And I think the idea of handing in an essay and seeing marks on it is just very poor comparison to it.
You didn't resent the fact that if you'd written a long essay, it might take 40 minutes or so, roughly.
I think you learn to time your essays. You know, you learn to try and make the points in such a way that you're going to get the feedback as well. It's all an exercise in balance and so on. But Iris could listen to something and could just come in straight on everything, and always to add and always to send you out looking at new things. She started us off on moral philosophy by saying, we're all far too young to know anything about moral issues. So before you even begin, you're going to go away and you're going to read Rousseau, Augustine, The Golden Bowl, forgotten, about five things we went off and we had to read. Now you'll know something about moral thinking. Now you can start. And she was like that all the time. She was always opening up extraordinary doors.
Lovely.
Great fun.
Anyone else?
Isabel Henderson, who was an ancient historian, very remarkably able woman at Somerville, very interested in political thinking in itself. I mean, using particularly Rome in her case as a way of looking at the way political animals work. A tremendous education, and just listening to what politicians say and thinking what they really want and aiming at and the weaknesses.
And did you do any other things like drama or?
No, never.
You worked pretty hard.
Not for me. Worked pretty hard. Had lots
first.
Of friends. No. Got a 2-1 in mods. Partly because I think my tutor was very anxious that I should do everything. And I should do Greek and Latin verses, verse composition, Greek and Latin prose composition, a whole lot. We had 14 3-hour papers, one after another, including Saturdays. And I wasn't good enough at things like verse composition, which I've done very little of compared. Most women never did it.
Mm-hmm.
It was usually the men who'd done it since they were at prep school. And I couldn't really cope with it all. And I think she pushed me into, she was very keen that I become classicist, proper classicist.
Mm.
And she pushed me into rather more of the extras of things like, well, I should have mentioned Professor Frankel. I mean, he was an extraordinary teacher.
Professor Frankel. What was his first name? Remember?
Edward. Yes. And he was very small and extremely tough. And he gave a seminar to which it was a tremendous privilege to be able to go. And one went through the text of people like Petronius or whoever and worked out what the text you were reading probably was. And each among you have a chunk of lines to go through and produce, you know, which manuscript you thought the reading was appropriate from and all that sort of thing. So we went through all the paleography of it and everything. It was terrific. Most of the people were graduate students. It was great to be there, but it was terrifying. It was to shout at you. And he used to sing the Greek, you know, iambics, dactyls, triplets, all those sorts of things. You could stand and sing them. Sing them. And he was a wonderful teacher and a very kind man, really. But also, you know, he was somebody one was warned never to stay in the room with on one's own, ever.
As a girl?
We all came in pairs.
Is that all right for the media? Is he still around, or...?
I'm afraid he's dead, poor guy.
Okay, so that's all right.
He was very old.
So you'd done this undergraduate degree in classics, which doesn't particularly employ you, educate you for anything except being a classics teacher. So what did you do?
Well, life had taken various turns by then, because in my third year I got engaged to a fellow classicist who'd stopped after mods and taken up Chinese. And I got interested in that. And I really wanted to change at the same time, but people said, no, you finish lots of grades. And I did the Sortes Virgilianae to decide whether this was sensible. You know, you let your Virgil fall open and put your finger on the page. And it said, you should sacrifice to your own gods before going off to foreign ones. So I completed grades. But in my final year, in February of my final year, he was diagnosed with cancer, bone cancer, with a lump there. It was already inoperable. There is a sort of cancer that hits the young when they're sort of switching mechanisms from childhood to maturity, which becomes a sort of racing bone disease. And so it was clear that nothing really could happen. Things sort of went on. I mean, I went on doing my degree until the leg broke across the bone and had to be amputated. At which point, of course, he was in hospital, and we got married in hospital as a way of, you know, at least showing solidarity, and actually in those days of having access, because we forget how difficult it was even in the late 50s, 60s. For an unmarried woman and a young man, even in hospital, to consort. So it was partly practical, but it was partly also a sort of thing. And the minute I finished my final exams, and St Anne's looked after me superbly, they knew that after every afternoon exam I went up to the hospital, they left me food in my room, they took total care of me. After the last exam, I got him out and he came home, and things went on until December when he died, at home, of which I'm proud. So
you were engaged, you didn't marry?
We were married, yes, we were married.
Was he in Lonsdale?
No, he was not in Lonsdale, he was a Griffin.
Griffin.
And his brother is still at Balliol as a classicist. No, he's just retired. Both from Christ Hospital, again, so family. And I had begun doing Chinese as a second first degree while he was dying, And I went on with Chinese after that, and so did a second first degree in Chinese, and went on from there to teach Chinese. But by that time, I had married a Lonsdale.
Mm. So how large periods of time are we talking about? I mean, did you stay in Oxford? In
62, we got married. I took finals, he died. 63, 64, I remarried. And I took schools in Chinese in 65, and my son was born 10 days later. So that was a fairly rapid change around.
Mm.
And I went on working in Chinese, trying to do a PhD with one or two children. Didn't work terribly well. I got into a subject that was difficult.
You were doing classical Chinese literature, is that
I
right?
I was working on the Yuan drama. It's a wonderful period of literature because under the Yuan dynasty, the Chinese themselves, the scholarly class, couldn't get political jobs. They weren't employed by Kublai Khan.
Hmm.
He only employed foreigners. So there was this enormous pool of talent which was not being used, and they turned it very often to dissenting drama, and the drama would be all about political messages, anti-Mongol messages. It's very, very modern in a lot of ways. It's a bit like Harvin or somebody, you know, as a dissenting dramatist. But they would tend to go back into old stories, you know, in which you read the present and the past and that sort of thing. They had to be a bit careful politically about what they said.
Mm. And this material has survived.
Oh, yes, particularly of two famous dramatists, Guan Hanqing and Ma Junhao.
We may get to the spellings of those people later.
Yes.
But why wasn't it a good...
A good topic, because I'd been trained in the classics to need to understand everything. And there's a lot to understand in a drama where what I'd got was, as it were, the texts between the choruses and music, which I knew had an enormous impact, because what we had was the song titles, which go back, and you can find them in earlier poetry, the same song titles. And I knew they were carrying forward a whole weight of imitation and reference. And it could have taken me 3 years just to have researched one thing. And I had a great supervisor, but of the sort who did, you know, believe the same thing. But, you know, yes, it would be wonderful to get all the answers.
Who was the supervisor? It was
David Hawkes, who is a professor of Chinese.
Mm.
And super.
Did he not warn you that this was impossible?
No, because I think for him it might not have been impossible, because his Chinese was so good.
Mm.
And he'd spent time in China, and he'd really got to grips with it. But for me it was impossible, because my Chinese wasn't good enough. Because researching Yuan dynasty drama means reconstructing sound values. You do that through things like Korean travel guides, which give you the pronunciation of Chinese words, and so you need a bit of Korean and you need Japanese for the sort of commentaries on texts, all that sort of thing. And I'd really gone about it as if I was trying to do 19th century classical studies with my knowledge of German and my knowledge of Italian or whatever, and I couldn't really.
But you obviously are a good linguist.
I like languages very much. I think it runs in the family.
Mm. To be even contemplated after an undergraduate degree is pretty impressive. And the texts were in British libraries or...
Oh yes, they're published, I mean they're republished. Ah. Still, oh yes, you don't have to reconstruct the texts for these things. Because printing had been invented long before.
Of course. Perhaps by the Chinese.
By the Chinese, indeed.
So as you began to realise that this wasn't working, what did you do?
I went on with it until the point when David had been translating a great Chinese novel called Hulamon, Dream of the Red Chamber, which is like Chinese Proust.
Yeah, I know. My wife has read it twice,
yes.
To my shame.
Yes. Yeah. And it was a huge undertaking. He'd been carrying the whole thing in his head so that, you know, the references were all connected and the dramatic ironies, everything was beautifully put together, and it's a wonderful translation. But he was completely exhausted, and he left quite rapidly and suddenly to go to Wales to breed goats for it. He's returned now, but he just needed to get away. He's a very Chinese sort of scholar, and that's what you do. You retire to your place in the country and you become a farmer for a little while. He did, which left his teaching to be done, which I did. So taking on the teaching meant that there was no time for two children, husband, doctorate, and then we had the year of the three diseases when we all had chickenpox, mumps and measles, one after another. At which point I gave up the unwanted struggle, and so the doctorate had not finished.
And this was about 68, was it?
73 by then.
Uh-huh. Right, so you taught for several years.
Oh, I taught several years.
At Oxford. For different colleges, for a number of
colleges. Well, doing the Oriental Institute, doing his Chinese lectures and teaching.
That must be about the time that you first went to China, was it?
I first went in 64. And I went as a phony secretary on a Board of Trade mission to sell scientific instruments. I was a complete phony, and they rumbled me fairly early on, because what I was doing in the evenings was getting away on buses and going and visiting people I knew. Because I knew already my own Chinese teacher from Oxford, who'd gone back to China with his wife, thinking that it was their patriotic duty, poor things, because they immediately fell into Cultural Revolution and had a dreadful time. And I also got a lot of contacts with Yang Xianyi and Gladys Yang, who were the editors of Chinese literature, and Gladys, whose English had been at St. Anne's way before, and Xianyi was a Merton man. And so I went to see them and met my first Red Guard in their house, because their daughter, aged 12, had her red scarf around her neck. And I'd been told by my English friends that I should take Xianyi a bottle of whiskey, because he didn't get enough whiskey in Beijing at that time. So I'd taken the bottle of whiskey, and it was on the table. And daughter came in, looked at everybody, said in Chinese, "That's bourgeois," and smashed it on the floor, and went out. And there was silence, nobody said anything. And when they knew she'd left the house, they said, "She's having a terrible time. We're very sorry for her, because she's mixed race, and they're giving her so many problems. So, you know, we know what pressure she's under to always tell on us, and how ambivalent her life is." So nothing was said, but I didn't take whiskey again. But I was meeting all these people, and then going back to the exhibition we were setting up. We were running a trade exhibition of scientific instruments for the Board of Trade. And eventually, one of my jobs was to go with one of our drivers to the post office, because in those days you communicated by going to the post office and sending telegrams. And so the daily telegrams needed to be sent. And he drove a funny route from my London. Then he stopped and turned round and said in English, "So who are you really?" So I thought, well, you know, it's simpler to tell the truth always, because otherwise you make mistakes. So I told him who I was really. I said, "I'm a student, and I'm doing a vacation job doing this. And really, I'm a student at Oxford." And he drove me off, and I went off to a place where I was put in a room to wait and think for a bit, and eventually sent back to the hotel, told I was to stay there. And the next day I was told to go back to the exhibition centre and go into a room on my own, and eventually somebody came in with a book, thrust it out, and it was a book called The Tanish Sambai Show, which is the equivalent really of The Golden Treasury. It's the nice anthology that everybody has of Tang poetry. It's really very well known. And they said, "If you're a student, you can translate this." So I had to sit there and translate as best I could from this book. And after a bit he said, "You're very bad, but you do know something. We think perhaps you are a student." So at that point I was not deported, which was nice.
Yeah. What... I remember you giving a talk and giving some impressions of China in those early visits. What was Beijing like in 1964?
Well, for me, of course, it was wonderful. It was wonderful for people in Beijing then as well, because it was just after Great Leap, when 30 million had died of starvation. And at last there was food in the shops again. And so, you know, people would grab you and say, can't see, can't see. Look, market, look at all this. And they were thrilled. And you know, one felt happy for them. I think that stage it felt as if things might start going right. Of course.
Did people talk about the Great Leap and the starvation?
Yes.
And you knew about it as
well? Well, they
talked
to me in Chinese about it. I knew about it anyway.
Because, as you know, Joseph Needham constantly denied that he knew much about it throughout his life.
He must have known. Actually, yes, I think it was perfectly well known. People were so naively thrilled with food that they weren't hiding what they were desperately hungry. So that was good, but also for me it was great because the walls were still around Beijing. It was a medieval walled city. There were still storytellers that I'd read about, you know, from medieval times onwards with the drum and bang drum. If you want to know what happens next, give me some money and then next instalment. It's fantastic.
So you felt a continuity.
Absolutely, yes. And children everywhere. Children everywhere underfoot, and big sisters with little sisters.
But everyone dressed fairly uniformly.
Everybody uniformly dressed, and everybody with, I think it was the five treasures, was it? Because everybody had the same alarm clock, bicycle, radio, watch, and sewing machine. And then they would say, it's so wonderful in the new China, there's no theft. And us cynical Westerners would think, no.
And the Hutong were pretty big at that time, I suppose.
Oh, a lot of people lived in the Hutongs. I mean, my first night in China, we were invited to dinner with a third secretary of the British Embassy, who was living out in a Hutong. He was David Wilson, ex-master of Peterhouse. So, he was the first person I met in China. And, he was very good, very, very good diplomat in China at that time, because his Chinese was immaculate, always had been. And he had also worked out the best way to get to know the populace, who are not supposed to speak to foreigners at all, was to have bought the most beautiful small red sports car you could imagine and drive it out into the villages around Beijing. And no Chinese could resist. You know, they would all come to this car and touch it, look at it. Inevitably they would start to talk, and inevitably there would be conversations. And so he immediately had a way of bridging gaps and finding out what's going on. So.
He brought the sports car from the West, presumably.
Oh, yes.
He went to Beijing.
From Hong Kong. No, nothing like it. They've never seen it.
Fascinating. So when was your next trip?
66 I went back. I was supposed to be doing a spell of Chinese language. It was the height of Cultural Revolution. We were deported after a month.
A week.
We were there a month, and we were out after a week. We were running around reading character posters. We were, you know, we knew too much, and we were a nuisance, and they hadn't got time, and so it just got rid of us.
And you got a good sense of what was going on here at that time.
Oh yes. I mean, what was always striking at that period, and went on for a long time to be striking, was when you see these white notices, which are about first of all, in this half is the sentence, and then in the second half is the execution, and they follow, you know, within an hour. And so any sense that there might be an appeal against anything that is due process really carried through, no, it just was always these white notices with two.
And this is literally execution.
Execution. Usually being shot in the back of the head. Yes. And that was something one went on knowing about, I think, when I was there in 78. I went back to take tour groups. It was one way of getting back free, as it were. And I took tour groups for Seren Sima and took the first group that went up Mount Taishan, and we were in Jinan in Shanghai and in the Shandong Peninsula. And they had a quota to fulfill of, I can't remember what the particular baddies were at that time, but there was a quota. And I remember the place was in a terrible mood. And the whole city, you could feel you were in a very difficult place. And I got my tourists out as soon as I possibly could. But in sort of trying to speed things up and having to go to endless bus offices and argue, saw, you know, processions of people being led to execution, which luckily my tourist didn't see.
What date was this?
This was 78.
78? As late as that?
Yeah. This was fulfilling.
I thought the Cultural Revolution was...
Cultural Revolution was finished, but we'd had the Gang of Four, and we still had trouble. And until Deng Xiaoping came in...
Really? Just went on till
then? Things went on in various ways. There were bad times. Oh, yes,
I didn't know. Did you have any sense of guilt about going to a place which was in which they were behaving like this? I suppose you...
No, I didn't. Simply because one came back and told people what one had seen. Because I believe in what Confucius says about, you know, the government is evil, but the people are good. And I've always felt that one should stand by people who are in bad regimes. And that one can, you know, I don't think one should let them make huge amounts of money out of the people, but I think some understanding of what a country is really like is better than nothing. I wouldn't want to take Turbroot to Zimbabwe at the moment. That's, you know, it's now become, I hope, the end game. But when things
Burma?
Are still... No, I wouldn't go to Burma. But I knew Suti. I mean, she was a friend in Oxford. And she always said, don't come, so I would never come. No, when she got her honorary degree here, and there was the empty chair, and Michael stood behind it, he'd been staying with me that night before. In the morning, he said, I'm going to try and get through to her again. He hadn't been able to get through for 3 weeks. And he rang, and we got her that morning and told her what was happening. It was marvellous.
What was she like? Or what is she like?
What is she like? What she probably is less like than she was very funny and very quickly playful with ideas and words and things. I'm afraid that probably has been driven out of her by awful life she's had to lead. Hard as steel, but loyal and, you know, if to family, to friends, to anybody, so kind. I mean, she would always go beyond what was normal to do things for people. And she would put herself always last. Just also beautiful to watch in everything she did. She just moved so beautifully.
Lovely person.
A wonderful person, yes.
What was the next sort of milestone in your life?
Well, I married Roger Lonsdale in 1964.
What was he?
He was at that point, he just got a full-time university lectureship at Oxford at Balliol, just finished a junior research fellowship at Balliol, from a Yorkshire family, from East Yorkshire, Hornsey. So Charles was born in 1965 and Kate in late 66.
What was his subject? What's his subject?
English literature, 18th century, a lot of work on delving behind the canon that emerged in the 19th century as what the 18th century was all about, and sort of reviving what the 18th century really was about, and particularly reviving a lot of the women's voices of the 18th century. So the Oxford Book of 18th Century Verse, Oxford Book of Women's Verse, Life of Charles Burney, which was his PhD on DPhil. Most recently, The Lives of the Poets, which was meant to be originally a Penguin, Lives of the Poets, and has now become the nth volume, big Lives of the Poets.
What are poets, though?
An awful lot of annotation. And Gray, Collins and Goldsmith, he always claimed that he got the best ratio of note to line. I think it's the curfew tolls the knell of parting day and the whole of the rest of the page's notes.
Well, this was described beautifully by Trevor Roper. He said, you know, your average medieval Oxford historian's article in the English Historical Review was a thin trickle of text through lush meadows of fields of footnotes.
Yes. Well, he knew this was, you know, what it was, but I always saw him as somebody who was very much at the coalface, producing incredible amounts of fact and of history and reconnecting things remarkably, which then other people would use. But he, particularly when he was doing the women's verse, he was allowed into the stacks of the Bodleian. I always used to feel it was a bit like having a miner in the family. You know, he'd go out in the morning and at night he'd come back. I'd been in the dark all day and completely black and almost needed to be scrubbed.
Literally is at the cold place of knowledge, isn't it? Yeah. The metaphor is right. So then what? When did you start with your... Well, you became the first director of international relations at Oxford, didn't you?
In 73, it was time really to stop trying to go on teaching part-time. There were various options. I had a job in the coin room in Ashmolean doing Chinese coinage, which I would have loved to do in a lot of ways, but it was a very female sort of job. And it seemed like a good idea to have a proper job. Because Oxford was like Cambridge. I mean, if you ever wanted to buy a house, you know, you needed to have two people earning a serious living. And so I took a job as a university administrator, first of all running the Oriental Institute, which was my home anyway, which was tantalising because I was so near and yet so far, so naturally rather agonising. But it was a good introduction to administration because I was very much on my own. And I had a lot of chances to use my own mouse about how things could best be done, and to learn everything I really wanted to learn about how to manage a university. We had a wonderful registrar who made us move around against our better judgment. We hated it because we would like a job and we'd get bedded in. And he said, no, out. And make sure that we knew, you know, about money, about buildings, about the whole way in which a university works, about planning, really to try and understand how complex a university is. And it all went terribly against the grain, as I said. I hated being so close to academic life and not being of it. And I got myself into a state about it. And then I could sort of hear my father saying to me, how can you be so stupid? Universities are human institutions. They were built by human beings. They're actually extraordinarily long-lived institutions. They're fascinating. You know, what are they? What are they for? How do they work? Every day is field work. And after that, every day is field work. And so, you know, whatever you were running or writing minutes for or something, you were also thinking, now, how and why? And, you know, why are we doing it this way, and in another institution, how would it be? And so then I got very interested in the university systems globally, and I got involved in training administrators in Africa, and becoming representative on European university networks, and just seeing what a curious institution this is. And you know, like all human creations, it is incredible. But hugely varied. And so that brought universities alive. And universities have been, you know, one of the important things ever since.
And you've done a succession of high-level administrative jobs in various universities.
Oxford, CEU and Cambridge are only three.
Yes.
In fact, but several different jobs in Oxford.
Hmm.
And then 64, '84. The reason why I went into anything which led up eventually to external relations was that the university had an information officer who was retiring, and the university said, well, you know, that's a salary we can save, we'll give up. And I said, I don't think you should. You know, 84 was already beginning to be a time, we'd been through 68 when most universities created their information officers, which was to deal with the internal troubles. Mm. Not with any kind of PR outside. And I said, let's look at this. And so they said, you can do it for a year or two, and then we'll give you a proper job, and you've seen this is a waste of time. So I started as a one-man band, and I ended up with information office, press office, publications office, events office, international office, all there by 1993, and I ended up as director of external relations. Gosh. And it was needed, because partly it came at the time when they were also thinking about a campaign.
Mm.
And they started, you know, we started building a campaign in 86.
Mm.
And all these things were clearly functions that we had to have, which had never existed before.
Mm.
Just as, you know, they encompass the sort of things that QDEN has, but there was a separate development office in Oxford with Henry Drucker and his director.
Hmm.
He was a good colleague.
Yeah, I heard of him.
Yeah.
I've met him.
Nice one.
Then the Central European University in Soros. Tell us something about that.
Well, I got involved in that because in, not sure, 89, 88, it was becoming clear that things were loosening in Central Eastern Europe. I mean, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, they're becoming very open. And George Soros turned up one day, and I think it was Desmond Neill was Vice Chancellor, and said, I've come from Harvard, I've offered Harvard all this money to run scholarship schemes for Eastern Europe. They've told me just to give them the money and get away. And I won't do that, so I'm here, and I'd like to work with you, but I want to work with you. And I want you to match this. I can't remember how many millions it was, but it's, I want you to match this and I want you to take it on. And Desmond Neill looked at me and said, Lonsdale, go and match it. And George said, I'll be back in a week. But that was fine, actually, because already I had been in talks with people in the Foreign Office who were saying, if only we could really make a breakthrough into these countries, we think they're loosening. And so I just went back to them and said, we've got this offer. Are you prepared to work with this? And they said, snap.
Gosh.
And so in a week we could go back to George and say, it's done. when do you want to begin?
Yeah.
The great thing that he'd found out, which was crucial, which made the difference to the Foreign Office, was that they'd said, you can choose your students. Up till then, they'd sent out men and Katura, carefully picked. But this, the breakthrough was, you can.
You being who?
You in the first instance, George Soros, and then Oxford.
Oh, right.
So we had the choice. So we didn't take the nomenclature. We don't think we did.
So this was a scheme to bring students from there to Oxford?
To Oxford.
I see. It wasn't the Central University.
No, but that's how I got to know George.
And then
when George set up the CEU, he said, well, you know, come and be its administrator, come and run it.
Hmm.
And so I did.
What sort of man is George? I have friends who are friends with him.
He's a very remarkable man. Mm. I like him very much, and I admire him very much, and I also know that I needed to look in the mirror every morning and say to myself, you can be out of here in an hour. Because that way you could say, no, George, we can't do that.
Mm.
And then you'd say, why not? And if you explain, I understand. You know, well, please try to do this.
Mm.
But you had to stand up.
Mm.
And it was fine. He's a very reasonable man, but he likes things to happen fast. Mm. You know, his life has been spent making very quick decisions and seeing immediate results.
Mm.
Universities are a bit slow.
I've noticed. And you spent, how much time do you spend living here?
I was totally
in Prague.
There,
or?
Well, Prague, Budapest, Warsaw, Moscow, and lots of other places.
Mm.
There were actually faculties of the university in Prague, Budapest, and Warsaw. Mm. And we set up something which we hoped would be part of the same thing, which became a Russian only institution, which is the Moscow School for Social and Economic Sciences, which I'm still interested in now.
Mm.
The thing died in Prague because Václav Klaus couldn't stand Soros and wanted us out, and because the Czechs really didn't want to be reminded of the past.
Mm.
They would always say, we're west of Vienna.
Mm.
West of Vienna, nothing to do with that. It flourished in Warsaw in sociology, and Warsaw was very lively always. The early days in Budapest, I have to say, were tough because there was a strong Hungarian sort of fifth column who would tend to sort of dispute any decisions and want to take over. It was difficult to keep the balance between the subjects, between the students from all countries, on the language basis, and all sorts of bases. But it was a fantastic time. Yeah, it was the nearest I've been to being in a revolution. Bliss was it in that dawn. I mean, people really did feel this is all new.
Were you there in 89?
I wasn't there in 89, but it was 91 was when the Soviet Union fell, and that was when one felt it really has changed. It's really free. And then the shadows of Yugoslavia began to gather, and then it was rather like the terror coming in with Yugoslavia, destruction.
What was your language?
The language was English, thank goodness. The language for getting one's car mended was Hungarian, Czech or Polish, with a lot of help from one's friends. I tried to learn Hungarian. I did learn some. It's a gorgeous language. The poetry is fantastic, but it's very, very hard.
Just be said about your European period, or shall we come to Cambridge?
There's so much to be said about it, I think we'd better come to Cambridge.
Okay, so when did you come back to Cambridge?
I came in 96.
96?
Yes, I was appointed in 95. I couldn't arrive before January, so I Tsar Steiner was my acting president until I arrived in 96. So I took over in February 96.
This is as
New Hall was president of New
President of New Hall. Tell me your reactions on arriving in that grey brick building.
It was all sorts of things. Like, I was astonished at how well they spoke English. I found myself sitting at a high table and thinking, they have a wonderful vocabulary, because, of course, I've been speaking the English of a lingua franca for 3 or 4 years. And also that people were incredibly nice. And I can remember having Oxford friends over, and there being the usual Oxford conversation. And people afterwards coming up and saying, is everything all right? because we'd been having a good argument, and people were much calmer, much quieter. I remember saying to some former head of high school, I can't remember which one, is everybody really always so nice in Cambridge? And he said, almost certainly, but just occasionally sort of make sure it wasn't that.
Is there a general difference in tone, do you think?
Oh, yes. Much more peaceable. Much less political, although that's changing a lot. When I first went on to, I must have been Provost Chancellor, that was in 1798, I think it was. Being at an early meeting with Alec Burrs and the senior management team, because we met at 8:30 on Monday morning, and discussing people running for council, and making sure that there was going to be a proper election, because certain members running for council whom we were not desperately keen on. And this having been decided, I said in Oxford speak, so how would you like us to get the vote out? And there was a terrible pause, but everybody looked pained. And Alex said, well, I think we wait to see how people vote, don't we? In Oxford, we didn't wait to see how people voted at all.
We fixed it.
We went out and, but we generally went out and lobbied and worked at it, just as if it had been a parliamentary election.
Now, how would you account? I mean, it's a very interesting contrast.
I can only assume that it's the much stronger scientific ethos of the place. I mean, I know that that the two places are both marvellous at all sorts of different things, depending on the people doing the subject at the time, but there is a more scientific attitude here. I mean, an observer's one. I mean, let's see how they vote. Let's watch them and see what comes out of it. Whereas in Oxford, it was, let's fix it. Let's get it done.
Was it anything... supposedly the relations between the university and the colleges is fairly different in the two places, in that Oxford, the colleges are more autonomous there.
So they always say, I'm never sure about that, because with the joint appointment system I can never understand how they can be. I felt that the colleges were much less supportive in Oxford, but I think that's because I came when I did at a sort of moment of change here. I mean, one of the things that I think must always be remembered about Alec, and perhaps isn't, is that he did so much for the colleges by fighting for the college fee. He was completely tireless. He was incredibly active. He carried all the colleges behind him. And I think the colleges committee changed into being a really useful body from that moment. It was a huge legacy, and I don't think he's ever valued enough for it.
I hadn't realised, I just read Neil Lennon's The Dons, mm-hmm. and I hadn't mm-hmm. realised how close it was under Margaret Thatcher mm-hmm. to losing the college mm-hmm. fee.
Oh, very, and of course very much again in the 1990s.
Was it?
Mm. Yes, very. They wanted it out. Mm. And, you know, with the help of a very friendly head of HEFC at that moment, we got through.
Who was
without
that?
It, we wouldn't have. I've forgotten his name and I didn't produce it. Because he's a former Oxford person.
Because you can keep, I mean, I've written a history of Cambridge and I more or less said, well, Henry VIII nearly destroyed them, and then Lord, you know, would have modified it considerably, yes. But after that everything was fine. And I hadn't realised it still goes on.
Oh, it's a daily fight.
And at the moment there's another threat, isn't there?
But oh, huge. It's been, I went into university management of various kinds and administration, however you like to describe it, in 1973. From that day, the amount of money per student has gone down in the British system. We have had less money to do more from that moment. And we've had, you know, the fights with government and the government pressure have just gone up and up. And I think both Oxford and Cambridge are absolutely right that they must diversify the sources of their funding. And a huge amount has been done. I mean, when I left Oxford, it was 65% dependent on the state. Mm. And now it's something like 27%.
What about Cambridge?
Cambridge is the same. That's exactly
I mean,
the same
could
process.
Could we make up that 27%? Because
well, I don't think we need to make up necessarily. I know I'd like to get it down below 10, and I'm sure we could. I don't think we have to kick it out because Harvard takes government money.
Yeah.
But he who pays the piper. You know,
because there's this new hefty plan to force the university or to fail it on its governance.
Oh yes, yes. Well, these have come and gone and come. And
that would mean that we'd have to take external. External board instead of self-government.
Yeah. Well, I'm all for, you know, biodiversity institutions. Mm. It's one reason why I like women's colleges. I just think you should have a huge range of institutions, all of which will bring something different. And I would deeply deplore losing the self-government of Oxford and Cambridge completely. Mm. I think we've done very well here. I think Garrison's trod a very delicate path. Between what will throw babies and bathwater out together and what is merely a bit of bathwater. Mm. It is a huge danger because these aren't just teaching institutions. You know, people have said it's like running an opera house or something. I mean, the people who are here are stars. They could all go elsewhere. And the only reason they don't is because they've got a stake in this place.
Mm. Exactly. But let's turn back to Newhall. Mm-hmm. What is the art?
Murray Edwards College.
Sorry, yes. Well, tell me about that. How did you... Your name will go down as the lady who procured for 30 million pounds from somewhere. How did you manage to do that?
Well, it goes back to Dame Rosemary, of course, as everything with Newhall does. Mm. When Newhall was set up, they couldn't agree on a name. Mm. So the Newhall was what was written on the incorporation document. And the new hall, for better or for worse, was used since, because there were various names and none of them were allowed for those reasons. So she always said, it's a dreadful name, never mind, when the benefactor comes along to give us the endowment, our foundation endowment, we will change the name, and they will have the choice of the name. So she told that story in her time, and I'd inherited it, and I inherited it from her. She was very forceful about it. She said, you know, it's nearly 50 years, come along. So I told the story everywhere because I knew when I arrived that the college was in pretty bad trouble. The buildings were falling down and morale was rock bottom. So the first thing to do was to get a really wonderful bursar, which we did, sort out what needed to be done with the buildings, deal with English heritage. And because I was on my own and I had no development office, nothing like that, I chose the most effective way of raising money, which was to go for the big and the name. And from the beginning, I went to look for a name. And various extraordinary and unsuittable people offered themselves.
Middle Eastern names.
And were brushed aside, and others were occasionally
flown. Bin Laden College of...
Not L5 College.
yes.
And there was one very serious and very positive supporter, who is still a supporter, whom I value greatly, but whose name shall not go down at this point.
Yes.
And at that point, because our buildings had been falling down, Ros Smith, Ros Edwards as she is, had emerged already with £1 million to help the collapse. She was one of the few alumni who ever rallied to the complete collapse of the dome, the dining hall, the kitchens, the library.
This and then can go on to interview.
And so I told Ros and Steve the story some time ago when talking about their gift way back, just as very casually. I had no idea that they were torn this league at that point. And I suddenly got a phone call saying, we've been thinking about it, we'd like to do it. They are enormously thoughtful people. They believe in a lot of good things, like the best thing to support is higher education, because that's what produces the doctors who cure the diseases, and the economists who help, and all the people who will actually change the world for the better will come through higher education. They also believe that we must make a move to philanthropy and to shouting philanthropy from the housetops, because Cambridge was sort of built on philanthropy until 1919. There was no government money in any British, either Oxford or Cambridge. We've got to get back to it. We simply have got to get back to it to survive. So the agreement was finally made with them in 2005, but luckily we knew about it in 2004. We were able to tell Rosemary, and she knew about it. And we said to her, we want to call College Murray. I said, well, we really do. Oh, well then. And she was very happy. And even on my last visit to her, just before she had the operation, which she didn't recover, she was saying, is it really all right? Is it really happening? Because, of course, her life's work was then secure at last. So that, I've forgotten quite where I was, but...
And then, so it's the Murray Edwards?
It's Murray Edwards, yes. And it's Edwards after them.
Yeah.
They decided that they could afford one really big gift. So the family decision was for us. He has an Oxford College that deserves a lot of support. I'm sorry that they were the unlucky one. But this is a family gift.
That's very nice. It's a woman's college.
Yes.
That's really lovely. I usually ask people just one or two general questions afterwards. One is about religion, about God. Who hasn't curiously come up in this interview yet, except in terms of second sight and things like this. Have you ever been, presumably you have to preside in chapel?
No, we don't have a chapel. You don't have a chapel. It's a secular college.
Okay, well, it's quite often the scientists I'm interviewing who have proclaimed themselves to be agnostics or atheists, like Pat Bates, and are standing up in King's Chapel.
Yes, no, I've never had to.
But what is your...
I have absolutely, if I'm anything, I'm a Taoist. I mean, the only permanent thing is change.
You're a Taoist?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes,
good.
Yes. I can't cope with complicated sort of anthropoid religions. I mean, my aunt always used to say, I can't understand a God who sent his own son rather than coming himself. rather sort of, if you start putting it into terms of human relationships, I just can't do this. You know, I can see that it was necessary to invent one. But the notion of an all-knowing, all-seeing, and certainly above all caring, kind of...
You've never been...
No, I don't think it doesn't exist in me. My father was a serious, straightforward Christian for whom the mysteries of complex physics merged into the mysteries of creation, but not me.
Not you. Another one generally I ask about is politics.
Yes.
What have been your...
Old-fashioned Labour, but not new Labour, I suppose.
What were your view? I mean, the litmus test nowadays is the Iraq War.
Oh, against. Shock, horror, yes. I mean, how could one live for something which would be so destructive, run by people who didn't know what they were doing?
Do you think we were lied to, or just...
Yes, I think we were lied to. I think we were lied to because I was told, and I tried to arrange an event before that particular moment, about 6 months in advance, I was told by a large corporation in this country, no, we'll be at war then. We hadn't actually declared war, and we hadn't been through the process at that point, but certain people already knew. And, no, I mean, for all sorts of reasons, I think we were lied to, but that's one thing.
Good.
And I've tried to do my best ever since to, you know, we started having Iraqi academic visitors in Newhall from first year after the war, and anything we can do to rebuild the situation and help with the academic rebirth of Iraq, that's something I hope to go on and do later.
Excellent. The other thing is, do you, amidst all your administration, do you still get time for any academic activities?
No, I'm doing an awful lot of things, but they're not academic. I think my real nature is to be a sheepdog, and so I need sheep. And so it's, you know, things like working with the organisation that my father worked on for refugee academics. I mean, I'm now the Honorary Secretary of that. Working with things of George Soros's in different parts of Central Asia and elsewhere. I'm always doing a lot of things, but
not UN drama.
Not UN drama. Eyesight partly. Yes, I couldn't cope with hoping to do a lot in old age. I don't think my eyes would be nearly good enough.
What are your plans now? Because this is your last year.
In September.
Yeah.
I am already very pleased to be the chair of CAFED, which will be very exciting, I think, for me, because I don't know if you know about CAFED. Started in Cambridge by Anne Cotton. Girls' education in Africa, particularly starting in Zimbabwe, then Zambia, Tanzania, Ghana, Malawi. Getting them into secondary schools, getting them out of secondary schools into some kind of ability to make some money, just so that they're not vulnerable, so that they can support the very extended families they have and that sort of thing. So that's institutions in 10 years has gone from her raising the money by baking cakes and selling them in Cambridge Market to the latest donation of 1.8 million from Goldman Sachs. And you know, there's an institutional upscale and a sort of succession to be managed. But I'm very proud that the organisation has only two expats, who are Zimbabweans working in Cambridge. Everything on the ground is done by the locals, who are remarkable people. So that I'm really looking forward to that. Going on with CARA, which is the refugee academics, and mainly Iraq, problems of what to do for the best for the Iraqi academic exile. I'm trustee of the European Humanities University, which was kicked out of Minsk by the loathsome Belarusian government, and is now in Vilnius. I'm trying to get that going. And dealing with the fact that we left the library in Minsk, and 3 weeks ago, three buses full of armed police in riot gear with live ammunition and Kalashnikovs came in to terrify 15 women running the library. So there's plenty to do.
You'll stay on in Cambridge?
I shall live in Cambridge, and my daughter and the grandchildren, who are very important, are in Oxford, so I've got two great places to be.
Good, well, I think that's probably a very... nice note on which to end, and to thank you very much, Anne, for a lovely interview.